Well, I've been in this field for a while, but actually this is the first talk I've ever given about hurricanes, so it could be interesting. I'm a little apprehensive. But I thought I'd start with this slide, and partly in response to some comments of Mike's this morning, where I think he was quoting someone else and saying that if you don't simplify it all, if your model has every possible bell and whistle in it, then it's a failure. I think that was Jim. Who said that? Or you said that?
Ian James.
Ian James.
It's in his book.
Yeah, very well, comprehensive complexity is an admission of failure. Okay.
Well, if you're interested in simulating, whether you're talking about climate projections or weather projections, there's value in being comprehensive because you're going to get the right answer. And we may be interested in understanding for a variety of reasons, but one reason we might be interested in understanding or interested in doing theory is that we want to improve our ability to simulate. That's where the really high-profile applications are, after all. And so how does climate dynamics theory in particular improve our ability to simulate? I've been struggling with that question for a number of years now, actually. And it's really, well, there are two new, you know, climate models are made up of some models of a lot of different processes, and I think Andy mentioned this morning that he felt they were one of the more complex systems.
The most complex of all the ones I've ever seen.
Some of us were discussing that because of a document we were writing, and we sort of came to the tentative, we couldn't think of another scientific discipline which worked with models more complex than our couple atmosphere ocean climate models. And we have difficulty, not surprisingly, in dealing with that complexity. And I could talk about that for a whole hour, but I think it would get kind of boring. But we can work on improving processes of climate relevance, or we can work more holistically, try to understand the climate system as a whole, and how does that improve our ability to simulate? Well, as anyone who's worked in a model development team knows, you put pieces together and it doesn't work right, and so you have to ask yourself, well, where's the problem? What's going on? And the only way you can begin to make progress on that with such a complex system is to actually have some understanding of what these models and what the system is doing and how you go about finding out what's wrong and how to improve them. So that's, I think, where holistic understanding comes from. I thought I'd start with an example of a simulation. This is something, I changed my talk this morning. I don't know if this is a good idea or not. I don't want to spend all of my time on this. This is something that's going on right now at GFDL, which is NOAA Laboratory where I work. And we're trying to simulate the hurricane season in the Atlantic. This uses a regional climate model with about 18-kilometer horizontal resolution. I don't have time to talk about the model in detail. But it's forced at the boundaries, as is typical in regional models, by, in this case, N-separate analysis, and it has observed ocean temperatures underneath it. There's no coupling to an ocean model here, which is a deficiency, clearly. And this turns out to be important. In the interior, we're relaxing the model to the largest scales in the reanalysis, and specifically that means in the domain we have, which covers all the North Atlantic, up to about 45 degrees or so. We're relaxing to zonal wave number 0, 1, and 2 in that domain in the reanalysis. If you look at what you're relaxing to, it doesn't have any storms in it. And if we redo a calculation with different initial conditions, we get storms in different places, which is sort of an operational proof that we're not forcing with this relaxation, we're not forcing the storms on the system.
One thing that is important is what time you pick for the relaxation time.
It's pretty strong. It's like 1 or 2 days. So
it's
we're,
one
really
day.
Forcing the system to retain the largest scales in the reanalysis. I want to come back to that point. I mean, this is mostly the work of Tom Knudsen, Steve Garner, and Joe Cerutis. And we're not using a convective parameterization. The model's non-hydrostatic, but at this resolution, 18 kilometers, that's pretty marginal. Probably doesn't matter. this is important. We tried calculations with different convective parameterizations, and case without a convective parameterization just works better.
So your smallest cock tower is 18 kilometers.
Right. Now one thing that happens is that, I'll show you some pictures in a minute, but what happens if we take out the relaxation in the interior? Well, we get too many storms. As, we, sort of as we discussed this morning. Now, so we've looked quite a bit at this, and what is the relaxation in the interior doing? It's basically restoring the large-scale thermal structure of the atmosphere. Now, if you try to run, at least when we try to run, a model without convective parameterization at this resolution, the troposphere gets too cold, and the atmosphere becomes too unstable. And so I don't think it's the, just that it's what you need the parameterization for in this context, we think, is to maintain a realistic large-scale structure of the tropical atmosphere. And you want it to get out of the way when the storms start forming. We don't know how to do that, though. We don't know how to maintain a realistic tropical atmosphere and at the same time have the parameterization get out of the way when we don't want it.
How big's the domain?
Here's a picture. This is the domain, basically.
That means all the all the deep convection has to be resolved.
Yes, all the deep convection is resolved.
Not just in the hurricanes, but anywhere.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, here's an example from 1987. We've done this for all the years since 1980. And so I'll show you a few figures like this. This is a record of the observed tropical storms. Is a standard database during 1987. Some people could probably name these storms in the audience. I don't know what that one was. And this is what the model does. This is, these are the tracks, the observed tracks. And these are the model's tracks. Also get some storms in the East Pacific, which I won't focus on here. And this is just in more detail, the strength of the model storm on these tracks. Basically got one, you know, significant storm during this year. This is a more active year. And this, these are the observed storms, these are modeled storms, and this is the little more detail. Year 2000. Got exactly the right number of tropical storms. 15. We've done this experiment three times. One time we got 14 storms, one time we got 15 storms, and one time we got 16 storms. There's not much randomness in the number of storms in our model, given the large scale structure of the flow. I should emphasize, I think I had it in the initial slide, that this is downscaling rather than prediction. We're not trying to predict the hurricane season for some initial condition in June or July. We're using the reanalysis and the sea surface temperatures from the whole summer season. But I should say downscaling is precisely what you want, you should be interested in if you're interested in the global warming problem. Because we have to assume that the, if you're going to say anything about the global warming problem, that our global models can tell us interesting things about, say, the mean or the statistics of the large scales over the Atlantic Ocean and about the SSTs. So downscaling is precisely what you want to be able to do to discuss the global warming problem. So we're sort of testing our downscaling capabilities.
Could you explain a little bit more what it is you're putting in about the year 2000 and what it is that you're...
Yeah, that's crucial. There's the sea surface temperatures from the year 2000. There's around the boundary of the region, in a region that's not really shown here, there's instantaneous meteorology of the flow, which we've experimented quite a bit, but it's not that important. It's not the big distinction between these 2 years. We can switch the meteorology of the boundaries and we get about the same number of storms. And it's this relaxation to the large scale structure of the flow over the Atlantic, which includes the vertical shear and the thermal structure and the stability of the atmosphere.
So the intensity of these under-resolved storms will be weaker than the natural intensity, I guess.
You can see them here. Yeah, we never get hurt, you know, four or five category storms, but we get some category threes. We can clock this in different ways. This is another year, 1995. There are model deficiencies, but a lot of model deficiencies when you look more carefully. We get too much development in a number of cases off the coast of the United States when you get a front, quasi-stationary front forming. And this year we got about the right number of storms, but we're not getting enough development in the main development region. So there are problems here. I'm not trying to hide anything. This is a work in progress.
Okay.
And 1982 is a very quiet year. Captured that pretty nicely.
But just to echo Andy's remark, your central strengths are not that much to me.
It depends. I've cheated a little bit. We've plotted surface pressure here rather than maximum wind. If we plot maximum wind, the storms look weaker.
Yeah.
If you look at the wind pressure relationship, the model is deficient, presumably because of its resolution. But if you look at central pressure, it doesn't look as bad.
So these storms, typically when you look at them, you look at the realization, they're actually much bigger.
Yeah.
So you're getting getting an approximate pressure drop, but you're not getting the gradients at all.
What's the bottom line, what we have up to date?
You can't expect any better.
This is year to year. Black is the observed number of hurricanes in the Atlantic. Red is the model result. Correlation's about 0.75, or the number of tropical storms.
It's interesting that you're getting.
When
a storm actually forms, when you get a big enough disturbance, then having no convective parameterization should allow it to grow. But you've got to get an initial circulation, and I wonder how you do that without. When you've only got convective explicit latent heat release on
a lot of waves roaming through the domain.
Yeah, but these waves would be weak. They wouldn't be reducing a lot.
Well, I think this is telling me something that there's something that's more deterministic coming from the larger scales that's controlled genesis, which is a little different from wind synthesis.
So you mean to say that?
I didn't show any results that show it, but we have results that support the
combination. So, do you mean to say that the waves coming in that eastern boundary aren't making a difference?
Well, I think there has to be some wave activity there, but when we switch the meteorology at the boundaries, that doesn't seem to be the problem. We're still doing some of those mix and match kind of experiments. We've also started some global warming simulations.
Yeah, the ones
and that's still a work in progress. I'm not going to report on that here. And so 2005, 2006 weren't on this, so we just started those. And it's a little bit disappointing. 2006 is too active. 2005 looks pretty good. Here we started from May 31st or June 1st because 2005 was very active in the early, very unusual as being very active in the early part of the summer. And 2006 is very quiet. And the model captures that. But it overdevelops things in 2006 in August, and most of that development is here extratropical. So the model is doing something fishy there. It's not developing at all.
Which is very, very interesting.
So there's a lot of stuff here to look at, and so this is an example of simulation. I mean, we're not trying to simplify the model here. We're doing the best we can with the existing computational power.
You probably already said this, but what model are you using?
This is one we just developed in-house. We call it, I could give it a name, but it hasn't been used very often. So.
Right.
It's just a regional non-hydrostatic. There's nothing special about the model itself.
Okay. Thanks.
I find that interesting that you get such a high correlation when the storms are not happening. The spatial distribution is so different.
We repeat these calculations and we get different spatial distributions and we often get very similar analysis. I don't know, it's still a lot of stuff here. But okay, so that was the...
The correlation of when the storms form
not very good.
Great.
Yeah, no, it's
and,
not.
But the fact that the large scale does seem to be so important and that the numbers seem to be, it's sort of a puzzle.
Well,
I find it kind of puzzling.
Steve Garner is looking at, pick 2 years, this 97 and 82. I'm not sure why he picked, 82 is low, right? 97 is high, and we're just mixing and matching things. And the most important thing is just the, well, there's the vertical shear is significant, but even more important is just the thermodynamic structure of the atmosphere in the main development region. Is what we think is the most important difference between the years.
So could you interpret that as like an air and air outbreak?
Could be. We haven't even got into that much detail. We just mixed and matched 1 year's profile with another year's profile.
So. Well, when you say the thermodynamics are more favorable in the MDR, presumably you're talking about more latent stability.
Yeah.
Or moisture and calm.
Yeah, more moisture or a cooler atmosphere. A warmer system. Okay, so that's an example of simulation that's ongoing. And now I'm going to switch. And there's a gap here in that talk about some idealized models, but I'd love if this idealized work would make more contact with the kind of simulation experiment that I was just describing. Maybe it will down the line, but this work is motivated by sort of an angst that's been building among a number of us, you know, about this complexity of the models that we're working with and how hard it is to deal with. And so I'm just thinking about the atmospheric component of our climate models here. You can idealize them. This is a pretty sharp distinction between what we call a dynamical core of the model, which is solving the equations of fluid dynamics on a sphere for an ideal gas, etc. And a lot of the subgrid scale closure and parameterization, which almost all happens in the vertical, just because the atmosphere is a thin shell and our models grid invariably has a small aspect ratio. So almost all of the subgrid scale stuff is happening in the vertical. So we call it column physics. It's just all the subgrid scale stuff that's happening. And all radiation, I don't know if you want to call that subgrid scale, but all the photons in these models are just being exchanged in the vertical. They're not exchanged horizontally because the aspect ratio of the grid is so small. So all this stuff is happening in the vertical. The surface fluxes, boundary layer models, and of course all of moist convection. And over the years, I and a number of people in the audience, in fact, have looked at models of this type. I'm calling type one for the purpose of this slide, which is keep the dynamical core. Now, solve the ideal gas equations on a sphere. And don't simplify that, rotation and everything. But just idealize the column physics and all sorts of ways. And just think about what the results are. Very interesting results emerge. But today I'm primarily going to be talking about, in fact, exclusively talking about the opposite of type two, where we keep the column physics of the atmospheric model. And we exercise this column physics in more idealized dynamical settings. And we're trying to understand this beast here. Say, why do we want to understand it? Well, we're using this model that I'm looking at to try to predict the future of our planet. And people are taking those projections pretty seriously. And so we're obliged to take these models pretty seriously ourselves. And this way of proceeding, where you sort of retain some of the features of the full model and idealize others, rather than just idealizing everything, is done, you know, consciously in the hope of making contact with the full model more easily by retaining a significant fraction of its complexity, and not simplifying everything all at once. So working with the GFDL global atmospheric model, it has a pretty complicated column physics package, which I'm not going to try to describe at all.
Have you ever counted the equations in the model just for fun?
Counted the equations. I'm not even sure what that means. This is some examples of type one, where we're just integrating ideal gas equations on the sphere and making simple assumptions about the moist convection in the model and getting very different kinds of vortices and strokes. So that's, I'm talking more about this, which is, okay, what kind of idealized dynamical frameworks can we exercise this column physics in? And one I find very interesting is called just homogeneous isotropic radiative convective equilibrium. What I mean by that is just fix the ocean temperature, put the dynamics is just a doubly periodic, the domain is a doubly periodic box. All the forcing is horizontally homogeneous and isotropic. If you just turn on the sun and see what happens, it's all. It's like sort of the analog of Baynard convection. You start evaporating water, you start condensing, you start forming clouds, you precipitate, convection organizes if it wants to, etc. And you can do this non-rotating or rotating. We're going to talk about the rotating case in a minute here. Let's talk a little bit about the non-rotating case first. Okay, it's non-rotating radiative convective equilibrium. So the radiation, because the fundamental driver here is the atmosphere is being cooled radiatively. It's cooling to space. And the ocean temperature is fixed, so it's being destabilized. And so the atmosphere starts convecting. And so what does it do? Well, you do this with different models, column physics packages, you get rather different things. This is what happens in our case. And it's kind of, it's a little discouraging when we first started doing this, and that these are resolutions that we, you know, people have done radiative convective equilibrium like this, non-rotating, in with what people call cloud resolving resolutions, 1 kilometer or so, in some fairly large domains now. So why are we doing this with such a poor horizontal resolution? It's precisely because we just want to, trying to have a sort of limited objective, trying to understand what our global atmosphere models are doing.
I'm puzzled. Are you using bulk cloud microphysics for your convective parameterization?
Just whatever is in the atmospheric model.
Oh, so that's your atmospheric model, not the. Sorry.
It's actually a relaxed air Schubert. It's our own Schubert.
Didn't you say that? I don't want to offend anybody who parameterizes it, but doesn't the fact that it's the convection itself isn't homogeneous means that parameterization is all posed?
Well, I remember a conversation a long time ago with David. I don't know if you remember that conversation. It must have been 20 years ago. Where, it was David Neal, actually. But, I think Dave Randall will probably say the same thing. But it was precisely that argument, that that's a test of a convective parameterization. You know, it should remain stable. Now this, I've run this kind of, I call this dynamic radiative convective, as opposed to sort of single column. These equations have solutions that are homogeneous, obviously. And I have a picture of what those solutions look like. They're totally unphysical in this case. First of all, they're periodic. You get this is cloud amount as a function of time. You get a periodicity of about 5 days. So this is our single column solution. If you do the dynamic rate convective equilibrium, there's absolutely no resemblance to this solution. So you're very far away from anything that resembles a weakly nonlinear instability as a homogeneous state.
But the surface fluxes are not necessarily horizontal. The radiation probably is. There are sources of homogeneity that you could point to.
I don't know, if you put in a homogeneous initial condition, it stays exactly homogeneous. I'm not sure what we mean. The thing that bothers us here is that all the convection, so these are two different temperatures, surface temperatures. At this lower temperature, all the precipitation is parameterized. It's the convective parameterization is doing the precipitation. But as we raise the temperature, we start getting large scale precipitation. So one could argue that this is a failure of the parameterization. Zeroth order, what is it convect? Presumably you don't want the model to convect. So if it convects on a good scale, that's probably a failure. When we go to a higher resolution model, and we've gone down to 50 kilometers, do that happens at a lower temperature. We also start getting more linear features. These are large scales. This is a 12,000 kilometer domain. Now, an interesting thing, I don't know if I'll try to come back to this, but if you take, we can manipulate the atmospheric model to prevent this from happening by changing the convection scale. We prevent the precipitation from occurring on the grid scale rather than through the subgrid scale curve. when we do that in our global model, all of our tropical storms disappear. So the model that produces more realistic tropical storms is this one, the one that has sort of the tendency to convect on the roots. I'll just leave that hanging there for a minute. Maybe we'll come back to it. So I'm not convinced that that's bad for an atmospheric model to convect on the roots.
So the experiment you just summarized was to change your convective conversation and allow
to avoid this
to avoid
kind of thing.
It, to avoid that.
Which just makes the convection less inhibited. This model has a little bit too much inhibition of convection, so it just convects
on the grid
scale.
But physically, I mean, you should sort of transition smoothly from one to the other.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we're not transitioning smoothly here, so I'm not defending the model here. I'm just trying to analyze it. But I think, you know, we give all these convection schemes names and talk about, you know, we write dozens of papers about the characteristics of one scheme or another. I think the zeroth order property of the convection scheme that's relevant for the large scale simulation is, does it suppress all grid scale convection or does it? A lot of schemes out there don't, and ours doesn't, especially as we raise the temperature. And then you can ask, is this important for our global warming simulations? We start developing more rain on the grid scale. And this is important for the climate sensitivity, it turns out. Yeah. This is from a paper that we recently published. So as we, this is the fraction of the precipitation in that domain that's large scale, that's actually happening in the resolved scales in the model instead of being parameterized. And this is the 200 kilometer model, and it starts developing a large scale rain at some critical temperature. But that critical temperature is reached at a lower temperature at a higher resolution model. So when we look at the resolution sensitivity of our of the tropics in our model, it turns out to be, at least in this homogeneous model, it's largest in this region in which one resolution has made its transition to large-scale rain and another resolution hasn't. And this is what we call the cloud radiative forcing, which, okay, as you convect, you start generating clouds in the model. We can ask, how do those clouds affect the radiation at the top of the atmosphere, the net radiation at the top of the atmosphere, which is a crucial thing for climate sensitivity, and just the energy balance of the Earth. And cloud radiative forcing is just a quantitative way of sort of talking about the effects of clouds on the energy balance. So I'm saying that the presence of clouds is cooling this model by 20 or 30 watts per meter squared or whatever. So this cloud radiative forcing, if the cloud radiative forcing is a very strong function of temperature, that's an important effect on climate sensitivity. And this is a stabilizing effect here because the cooling effect of clouds is increasing as we increase the SFT. That's a, if that were happening in a global climate model, that would, the model wouldn't warm at all in response to the SFT. But it's totally a function of resolution here. However, if we plot, this was the interesting thing, if we plot this cloud radiative forcing, which is sort of an integral measure of the organization of the clouds, the organization of convection as it affects the energy balance of this model Earth, see that it sort of collapses. It's a function, it seems to be a function of the fraction of the rain that's large scale. And that holds up as we vary different things in the model. Right? Don't worry about all these symbols, but this is just varying different things in our convection scheme. And can sort of predict how the cloud radiative forcing the model will vary as we, just by knowing how much large scale precipitation is in the model. We'll come back to this if we have time. Try something else. This is kind of abortive, but I thought I'd mention it. But people call it a Mach-Walker cell. You can just take the same non-rotating homogeneous geometry, but create a new homogeneity by just making the ocean temperature sinusoidal, just sine of x times some temperature. And just, so now you've organized the convection and you get a Walker cell, which is the circulation in the Pacific, where you get convection in the West Pacific and sinking ocean in the East Pacific. But the bottom line here is that this kind of experiment was extraordinarily complicated, and we haven't been able to make, this is changing different parameters in our model. And we get, this is time, And this is space here. So saying that the way that the convection organizes itself is remarkably sensitive to the details of our column physics. We meant to go back to this, but it was just too daunting. We just haven't been able to get our hands on it.
So you get some coarse grain walkers?
Oh yeah, all these generated
sure,
coarse grain walkers. But if you like the structure of their sort of non-rotating ITCZs, it's profoundly different.
It would be interesting. Vortec has done old simulations with CRMs and put those up alongside these. It would be interesting.
I don't know, these are three-dimensional, first of all. You've done some 3D stuff too, right? Haven't you?
Yeah.
If we do, if we can make this 2D and the results change completely. But, so 3D is important here. So I'm not going to talk about the Mach-Walker cell. Well, let's put in rotation. So it's exactly the same calculation I just described, but add the constant Coriolis parameters. So it's uniformly rotating. It's still homogeneous isotropic. And now what happens? This is surface pressure snapshots. And these are three different resolutions, about 200 kilometers, 150 kilometers. Well, the end state of this model is the set of tropical storms. I don't think there's any other way to describe them. And they're pretty strong, typically. This is 29 to 960. And as we increase the resolution, we're trying some calculations now with a little bit higher resolution. And impression of some convergence, and I'll have a figure later, I think, that the number of storms. Does it have a figure? No, but the 200 kilometer calculation tends to stand out, and 150 are a little bit closer to each other. So, adding this is a rotation corresponding to 10 degrees north latitude. It's not a huge rotation, it completely changes the organization. Okay, this is sticking to the 50 kilometer resolution and changing the sea surface temperature. And the number of storms decreases as we increase the system. They also get more intense, as I think you can see. Now, so that's the key thing we want to focus on here, which we're trying to focus on. I'll say a few words about it. Why do the number of storms decrease?
But haven't you already solved that problem in your paper on rainfall versus, because all the rain is coming from this now.
Okay, well, let's, I think we'll have time to discuss it.
Okay.
This is what the precipitation looks like in those same three simulations. This is a nice one, it's just the magnitude of the surface wind. It sort of gives you the feel for the region of influence around each storm very nicely. And you also see the eye wall. These are, talk about large eyes, Wayne. These are, this domain is 20,000 kilometers by 20,000 kilometers. So these eyes are, I think they qualify as a big eye here. There's probably several motes in there.
So are you going to explain why rotation removes the sensitivity to the parameterization of this?
I didn't say that, but it's absolutely true. There isn't much sensitivity in these rotating cases to the details of the parameterization. Thanks, Jim. All I can say is that we've fallen into an attractor, since we're in a math building, which is not that sensitive. The final state here is not that sensitive. You know, compared to the non-rotating case, we've just fallen into a state that the system's very happy to be in, which is basically closely packed, I guess I'd say. Mature tropical storms.
Might add, maybe because it throws a little bit of light, that we do exactly these things as we have done, not with the same model, but with a so-called cloud-resolving model.
I should say
you don't get this unless you're high enough SST or Coriolis.
Yeah.
You've done a big domain like this.
Error results. You have to get at high resolution.
How big was your domain?
1,000 kilometers.
Yeah, that's, I don't think that's big enough.
So you get one or
I'm
two.
I'm reserving judgment about that.
You get two or three.
But 20,000 by 20,000.
Let me just defend it, because I think that domain size is very limiting if you want to know the steady state. The transition from popcorn convection to that may not be
successful. So I think the real question is, okay, have we, as Mike and now Carrie is, emphasizing, does this kind of model just make it too easy to get into this mature state populated by strong tropical cyclones? I'm keeping an open mind about it, but your paper hasn't come out yet, so. Kerry and Dennis Hartman has done some calculations similar to this too with mesoscale resolution. So there are other people doing this kind of thing.
And their results are different,
though? Dennis's domain is just big enough to have one storm. I have to study Kerry's look more carefully. Vince West.
Is there land masses in this?
No, it's homogeneous.
It's
homogeneous ocean.
Homogeneous,
fixes.
That's like a water world.
Yes. And there's no dynamic ocean, which is another big efficiency.
So it is, I mean, just off your cuff, whether it's physically relevant.
Mm-hmm. It's relevant for the models.
It's relevant for the model.
That was my original motivation.
It is remarkable how a little bit of rotation, 10 degrees north, produces a very stable attractor. And why that is coming from, to me, it's fascinating.
This relevant point, which I... So this model, somewhat lower resolution, but that doesn't make any difference for the quality of the picture, behavior of this picture. In our global configuration, produces essentially no hurricanes in the Atlantic. We get almost no hurricanes in the Atlantic, and it's a real interesting deficiency of our global, which we'd like to understand better. But if you put that same physics in this horizontally homogeneous framework, it's perfectly happy to gravitate to this mature state. So there's the inhomogeneity that's going on in the model is preventing the genesis. It's not like the global model is incapable of preventing this genesis. And this is the summary of some of those statistics. Let's just look at the 50-kilometer case. This is just a PDF of minimum surface pressure. It's easy to count these storms. They're unambiguous here. And this is, as we increase the SST, the number of storms is decreasing, and the average intensity is increasing. The intensity is increasing with SST. But it's rather modest. If you look at the intensity increase per degree SST, it's sort of what you get from potential intensity theories. There's no bells or whistles. It's a pretty small effect in this model. This is just maximum wind speed. It's the same thing. And this is just the number of storms at the different resolutions showing how it decreases with increasing SST. So let's think about why that happens. And what Kerry was referring to was following simple argument that look at how the precipitation changes. Just the domain average precipitation as you increase the sea surface temperature. Well, it's almost independent of resolution. It's extremely simple. And it's increasing at about 3% per degree. Which, that's an interesting number. But the important thing is you have to compare it to another number, which is just the Clausius-Pipeline equation, which tells you how fast the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere increases with temperature. That's about 7% per degree. And if you look at global models, picture here actually. Yep. This is looking at the IPCC global models in this in the archive that's been set up, and just asking over the typical 21st century scenario for the aficionados, it's the A1B scenario, and looking at just the total water vapor in the atmosphere. And this is the temperature change over the 21st century in the different models. They have different climate sensitivities, so you get some range, but they all basically follow Clausius-Clapeyron, which means the relative humidity isn't changing very much in any of these models. And look at the precipitation. It's also increasing, not as simply with increasing temperature. It's actually less than 3% per degree. It's more like 1.5% or 2% per degree. It's kind of interesting why this idealized model, precipitation increases a little faster than the global models, but in any case, it's quite a bit weaker than Clausius-Clapeyron. Now, what's the relevance of that? Well, there are different ways of thinking about it, but if you just think of the hydrologic cycle as due to a massive change between the boundary layer and the free troposphere, it's So the air goes up, it has a lot of water vapor, and a lot of that precipitates out and comes back relatively dry. So you can either ignore this return flow of water or just assume it's proportional to the amount coming out of the boundary layer to get the same scaling. And this, the result is precipitation is proportional to the mass flux, this mass exchange, as the amount of water vapor you have in the boundary layer. But if the water vapor is increasing by 7% per degree, and the precipitation, to say why is the precipitation increasing 3% or 2% or whatever, that's determined by how fast the atmosphere is cooling, really. Because you have to resupply that heat, and the way you resupply is by latent heat. With condensation, there's really not much freedom there. The only thing you can do to the system is do something weird with clouds or something that somehow changes the rate to cooling of the atmosphere. But it's a very conservative, if you like, statement to make that the precipitation is going to not change very as rapidly as the amount of water in the atmosphere. And that means that the mass exchange between the boundary layer and the free troposphere has to decrease, it's like the line of convection. We're talking about the tropics, has to decrease. We're talking about sort of deep precipitating convection in this argument. And there are other ways of making this argument. Maybe I should mention this too. It turns out to be essentially the same argument, but the picture that the tropics are dominated by narrow convective cores, where you have the upward motion and then you have subsidence in between. That's sort of a kinematic picture of what's going on in the tropics. So the end result is that you can think of the heating, the latent heating is balanced by the adiabatic heating due to subsidence in the large scale environment outside of the convective cores. The tropics on the whole are close to a moist adiabatic. And determined by the regions that are convecting and the fact that temperatures have to be flat in the tropics. The convecting regions are determined by the temperature profile. And if you just average, this is the dry static stability, the rate of change of the potential temperature or the entropy with height, and you average that over the troposphere on a moist adiabatic, you just get something proportional to the amount of moisture. So the bottom line, this kind of argument was made by a number of other people historically over the years, by Suki Manabe in particular. And as you get warmer, your dry static stability increases. And therefore, for the same amount of, your subsidence weakens as the climate warms if your total amount of heating doesn't change sufficiently rapidly. Because this changes like, the static stability changes like Clausius happens. And if the radiative cooling or latent heating doesn't change as rapidly, then your subsidence has to weaken. This is just testing this simple theory against the global atmospheric model. It works almost perfectly in explaining the changes in the amount of convection in the atmospheric model. So there's nothing very complicated. So is that what's going on in these simulations then, that the reason the number of storms is decreasing? In this idealized geometry, all the convection essentially is in these tropical storms. So if in some sense the amount of convection has to decrease as the climate warms, then one way of doing that is just to have fewer storms, especially because the storms are becoming more intense at the same time. So that seems like a plausible idea. Can I have a couple more minutes here? I don't know what we're doing. Because I want to show some other... Now we vary the rotation rate. So if you think these storms are big, you should see some of these that occur at the middle of the rotation rate. Really big. So this is 5 degrees latitude, 10 degrees latitude, 20 degrees latitude. The number of storms changes dramatically with changing rotation rate. And
but the ones that have weaker rotation than the Indian are stronger. The F5 north is those storms. Is that correct?
I got a picture here.
You're not changing the temperature. You're just jumping.
You're just changing the rotation.
Yeah. So
Look at the blue here. If you focus on the 55 kilometer model, the change in it's pretty subtle. There's a little change in intensity.
Okay.
That's with rotation, yeah.
Yeah.
But the number is reduced tremendously. Even though the intensity has not changed that much. There's still a lot here we don't understand. So one, if it's some Rossby radius, for example, I put this in quotes. Don't worry about the quotes. So you're supposed to, it's a Rossby radius, some static stability times some vertical scale divided by the Coriolis parameter. So it's effective influence of, say, a heat source in a rotating atmosphere would have this horizontal scale. So if this were the relevant scale for the separation between storms in this kind of model, then the number of storms should go up quadratically because of a square domain. And it doesn't really work, but then again, at higher rotation, when the storms get small, the solution isn't convergent at all. So it's not obviously following the radius information. Okay, the other, before going to that, when we increase the SST, something that happened, which I didn't show, but I sort of talked about indirectly, is that the dry static stability of the atmosphere is increasing. It increases by a lot over that temperature range that we were talking about. It increases almost a factor of 2, maybe more than a factor of 2, because it's just proportional to Clausius factor. And so another, if you believe that something like the Rossby radius deformation is important for the spacing between storms in this geometry, you'd say increasing SST just increased the Rossby radius because it increased, again, the dry static stability. I'm a little skeptical about it for a variety of reasons, but that's sort of another direction.
I should mention that there's the scaling of hurricanes gives you a different outer scale, which is the potential intensity divided by F now.
Right, so you could replace.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the arguments follow still.
So you could replace this NH in quotation marks by potential intensity. I'm not sure how well this would fit. We're just getting started. We just sort of finished this kind of thing. Here's a. Something else. Is the change in intensity what's driving the change in number? And so, is there some other way of manipulating the intensity of the storms? And yes, there is. You can change the surface flux formation. And I won't go into the details of how he did it, but sort of following some of Carey's ideas and others in the literature, we know a little bit about how changing the surface flux formation will affect intensity. And so, we sort of guessed right here. We tried to change the roughness formulation. This is the drag formulation for momentum and heat at the surface. How much flux you get per unit surface wind speed. We do get just look at the blue again. We do get an increase in intensity, but a rather subtle change in number here, as you can see from these PDFs. But it's not evident that it's the intensity itself, and somehow because it's competing more effectively with its neighbors or something, sort of crowding them out. That doesn't seem to be what's happening.
Is it increasing the roughness from green to dashed blue? Is that what you're doing?
Green is a 100 kilometer model, so just ignore that. The blue goes from here to here.
Okay.
So we went from a scheme in which, in this case, the drag coefficients for momentum and heat are proportional at higher wind speeds. Whereas in our GCM formulation, the drag for momentum becomes quite a bit bigger than the drag. This is the SST case, so it's not really behaving like this. So this reduction, we would argue, is not just due to the intensity. So
sorry to bother you about that. Yeah. So which is which? The blue is what? The green is what?
The green is just the 100 kilometer model. The blue is the 50 kilometer model.
Okay, but
and
you change the surface Bronco number effectively.
Yeah, and we went from the solid blue to the dashed blue when we did that. It changed the average intensity, but not the number.
Okay.
In this hurricane dominated regime, the entropy production must be overwhelmed by the boundary layer dissipation. And how does that? We have these large scale constraints on entropy export radiatively. How does the model meet those with
entropy? We started looking at the entropy budget. Yeah. This is a closed domain. And one way we're looking at it, and I think we think this is an important constraint. I skipped this one. But just taking the total power dissipation in the domain, which is just the strength of the energy cycle, how much kinetic energy you're generating, which you then dissipate. And most of that you're dissipating at the boundary layer, the frictional dissipation. And you normalize it by the total amount of latent heat, the precipitation, right? So it's sort of a measure of the efficiency of the system, because you think you're being cooled radiatively at a rate which is balancing the precipitation. So it's a measure of the efficiency of the system as a heat engine. And forget about what these numbers actually mean, but the bottom line is this normalized power dissipation is remarkably stable. And I think we can use this indirectly to help us understand how the intensity and the number are related, because they're both related to the dissipation. But haven't worked out the details. It's an open question, looking for help. So anyway, this is a fun dynamical system. It's not idealized enough for mathematicians, I think, because they're still using the column physics from the full global atmospheric model here. I think the goal here should be to now to assuming that this is an interesting dynamical system. I don't know. There's the question about whether everything is dominated completely by the convective parameterization. But I could try to do much more idealized models of rotating the H to convective equilibrium to address some of the issues. So I'll stop there.